Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Lindsay Zuzumbo, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. This is the 14th event in our 16th annual Siciliano Forum. This year's topic is the future of higher education. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over 70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website at hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Creative Solutions for Higher Education. I'd like to introduce Emily Wallace, who's with the Honors College, to introduce our moderator.
Thank you, Lindsay. And welcome to all of you. We're so excited to see you here in attendance today. On behalf of the Honors College, welcome. Dean Sylvia Torti is here as well, and I know that we are just both thrilled to see everyone here. Our panel today will be led by the Honorable Judge Judy Atherton. She was appointed to the 3rd District Court in August 1995 by Governor Michael O. Levitt. She serves Salt Lake, Summit, and Tooele counties. Judge Atherton received a Juris Doctorate from the University of Utah College of Law in 1983. She has served as staff counsel for the Legal Aid Society of Salt Lake and as an Assistant Attorney General in the Criminal Appeals Division. Judge Atherton has been co-chair of the Standing Committee on Children and Family Law, served on the Committee for Improvement of Jury Service, and the Board District Court Judges. Currently, she is a member of the Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice and the Utah Judicial Council. She also sits on the Council's Management Committee. Judge Atherton is assigned to the Criminal Division of the 3rd District Court and since 2004 has supervised the 3rd District Mental Health Court, a calendar that addresses the needs of mentally ill defendants in the criminal justice systems. Everyone, please welcome Judy Atherton and the rest of our distinguished panelists, and we'll begin.
Thank you, Emily. It's my pleasure to introduce today's panelists. Starting to my immediate left is Dr. Cecilia H. Foxley, who many of you know. She's Commissioner Emerita, which is correct Latin pronunciation, of the Utah System of Higher Education. Dr. Foxley served for over 10 years as Commissioner of the Utah System of Higher Education and Chief Executive Officer to the State Board of Regents. She's the longest-serving commissioner and thus far the only woman to serve in that position in the state of Utah. Dr. Foxley has worked as an executive consultant to a variety of education, business, civic, and government organizations and agencies, including the higher education system in the United Arab Emirates and several U.S. state systems and institutions of higher education across the nation. She is author of numerous publications on educational leadership and administration, human relations, education, and equal opportunity. Her institutional experience includes faculty and administrative positions at Utah State University, the University of Iowa, and the University of Minnesota. She also served as Regents Professor at the University of Utah following her 18 and a half years in the Commissioner's office. Dr. Foxley is a University of Utah alumna, completing both her master's and PhD work at the U. She received an undergraduate degree from Utah State University and completed postdoctoral internship with the National Training Laboratories Institute for Applied Behavioral Science. To her left is Dr. Martha Bradley, I won't say old, I'll say long time friend, who is now Associate Vice President for Academic Affairs and Dean of Undergraduate Studies here at the University of Utah. Dr. Bradley is professor in the College of Architecture and Planning, who teaches history and theory classes. Between 2002 and 2011, Dr. Bradley served as Dean of the Honors College and became the Associate Vice President of Academic Affairs and Dean of the Undergraduate Studies in July of 2011. She is an award-winning educator, the recipient of the University of Utah Distinguished Teaching Award, the University Professorship, the Student Choice Excellence in Teaching Award, the Benyon Center Service Learning Professorship, the Park Fellowship, and the Borchard Fellowship. In 2008, she received the honorary AIA Award from the AIA, that's the American Institute of Architects of Utah. She is the Vice Chair of the Utah State Board of History and Chair of the Utah Heritage Foundation. Dr. Bradley's published and academic works focus on public history, gender, community, and the religious community. And to her left is Dr. Barb Snyder, Vice President of Student Affairs here. She served as Vice President for Student Affairs at the University of Utah since 1999. She previously served in upper administrative positions at the University of Nebraska at, is it Kearney? And Iowa State University. She serves as a member of the President's Cabinet and the Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs Academic Leadership Team. She also teaches graduate courses in the Department of Education, Leadership, and Policy. She is widely recognized for her expertise in national public policy, Greek affairs, and executive compensation. She has presented countless programs and is asked to speak regularly on issues important to students and to student affairs. In 2010, she received the award for outstanding service as a dean, one of the most prestigious national awards in student affairs. Dr. Snyder holds degrees from The Ohio State University and St. Cloud University and received her PhD in higher education administration from Iowa State University. She has served on numerous boards, including 3 terms on the board of National Association of Student Personnel Administrators, and as the past president of that foundation board. And finally, Dr. Geralyn McIntyre, President Emerita of Central Washington University, former University of Utah interim president. She is President Emeritus of the university and holds emerita status as interim president, vice president for academic affairs, and professor of communication at the University of Utah. She spent 23 years at the U, serving as interim president twice in 1991 and for all of 1997. She was also vice president for academic affairs for 7 years. She is the first woman to have served in any of these administrative positions at Utah and at Central. So as you can see, our panelists are very well qualified to speak to the issues being addressed today. And I'll ask each of them to do an introduction and a few introductory remarks. And who wishes to start? Okay.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with a number of women that I admire greatly. I guess I'm the oldest one here, so I'll start. My career as an administrator actually began when I was a faculty member at the University of Iowa. That was back when Cece was there as well. The farthest back I could go in statistics on the percentage of women presidents there were was 1981. So I'm talking about 1973. In 1981, only 3.8% of the presidents at institutions of the kind that Utah is were women. And I'm just assuming in 1973 it wasn't any better. It was probably worse. I hadn't had any role models as a young faculty member. If anyone had said, do you plan to become a president, that would have been the farthest thing from my mind. As an undergraduate, I can remember only 2 tenure-track faculty members who were women. I do recognize that some of them were adjunct status. So I thought I'd really made as much of a statement as I could make by becoming a university professor at that point. Because I think at that point, the figures are 1981 again, 10% of the faculty were women. Now, things have gotten better. But I do believe, kind of in concert with our theme today about the future of higher education, that while the glass ceiling that I saw there at 3.8% or less for women presidents may not be as firmly in place, it may have been cracked a little bit, but it is still there. So I'll be glad to share some insights about how I made my progress to the point where I was a university president. It involved a lot of mentoring from both men and women, but women who are here today, Cece and Teddy Safman, have been tremendously important in advancing my career. So was Chase Peterson. Mentoring helps. persistence. I don't know that I can claim creativity, but I would say persistence. Ability to have confidence in yourself. And that comes from engaging in service at whatever level. I mean, I had been in leadership positions in college and high school, and that may seem irrelevant to your later career, but it isn't. For that first job, the leadership experience is tremendously important. So that built along the way into a position where eventually I was in what's called the pipeline. A couple concluding thoughts. There is a glass ceiling in part because there was gender bias at that time. I think there still is. It's probably more subtle now than it was before. I remember being in a committee meeting where we were reviewing tenure files of faculty members, and a male faculty member wrote in praise of one of the women being considered, "She's very good for a woman." And thankfully, everybody in the committee meeting at the time had the reaction we had today. They were horrified. But that attitude did persist, and it may still exist to some extent in some disciplines. I would say the other thing, and there's a handout that I've provided that might just be useful to refer to. I think for advancing in leadership, other than the fact there aren't enough role models for women to aspire to leadership or people to think a woman might be good in this role, but there has been an assumption about women's leadership styles. And I think that probably is another one of the issues that is a kind of subtle gender bias. The handout that's being distributed is from a book called Reframing Organizations by Lee Ballman and Terrence Steele. And there are four frames of the cultures, organizational culture, that they talk about. One is the political. It's a contest for power. The second is human resources. This is where you see the culture as a family and you build relationships. The third is structural. It's basically delegating of power within a hierarchy. And the final one is symbolic, extremely important in university. You realize that the culture is built a lot around symbols and rituals. I mention that because I think most people assume, and I think falsely, that women are the human resources. They're good at relationships and they build families. The point of Bowman and Deal's book that I want to leave with you and then listen to the other women here is a good leader does all of them. It is a situation specific. Leadership is situation specific. It is not gender specific. So for all of you, both male and female, don't let yourself get stereotyped into an assumption about what kind of leader you're going to be, because you should be all four of those kinds of leaders. So I'll be interested in your questions.
I'll go next since I'm in line for that. and thank all of you for being here. It's wonderful to see so many students in the audience, and we're delighted to have this opportunity to share whatever little tidbits of wisdom we might have. I took a very traditional route into student affairs work in higher education administration. I was very involved as an undergraduate student, probably more than my parents would have liked to in terms of my academic progress. But I took advantage of everything that Ohio State had to offer in wonderful ways. And I had a young advisor, an assistant dean of students, who said, you ought to think about going into student affairs. This was in 1974, similar to the years that Dr. McIntyre is referencing, and the profession of student affairs was very young at that time. It's still a very young profession, but it was there were many roads to get into student affairs, and there weren't very many professional practice programs in place at that time, not very many good ones. So I decided to get a master's degree in counseling, and I wanted desperately to move out of the Midwest. I said I'd take a job on either coast, and I ended up at Iowa State University. And from there, I have kept moving west, young woman, and now I'm a not-so-young woman, and now I've ended up in Utah for 14 years, and this is as far west as I plan to go. But it has been a wonderful career and many, many opportunities. As Jerry mentioned, many times reaching a glass ceiling. When I was appointed Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs at the University of Nebraska at Kearney, I was the first female at age 36 who had served as a vice president in the Nebraska system, and they were bent on making that the point of every announcement that I was the first woman that had done anything. And for much of my professional career, Certainly not now, and certainly not in this environment. But for much of my professional career, I have been, if not the only woman at the table, one of very few women at the table. And I was struck as I was thinking about this group, when you talk about the inferences that Dr. McIntyre is making, it's very interesting to me that I think all four of us possess the ability to be strong and the ability to be passionate and compassionate and gentle, and to lead in ways that need to be taken at that time. And I think we all have similarities. We're not only dressed similarly, we have those similarities as well. For all of you students that are thinking about important junctures in your career, one of the most important ones for me was deciding how much education I needed to get in order to get to where I wanted to be. So at some point, if you're going to be in education, you have to decide, am I going to get a doctorate or am I not going to get a doctorate? Now, if you want to teach, it's not even an issue. But if you want to move up in administration, that's particularly at this type of institution, that's absolutely essential. But that decision was made for me when my daughter was 6 months old. So I went back to work from my maternity leave, and I started my doctorate the same day. Not a good idea. So thinking about intentionality relative to getting the credentials that you think you're going to want to have, even if you don't need them, some of those academic credentials are the things that will either get you in the door or not get you in the door. And that's true regardless of your gender. So being thinking in the long term, thinking about the life term rather than the short term. And the other thing I'd like to mention is someone told me once, one of my former bosses and mentors, that you will make critical decisions in your life about work. And you'll think the most important decision that you make is where you go when you take a job. He advised me that the most important decision was when you leave and when it's time for you to say, my work here is sort of finished and my energy is out for this and I've accomplished what I can. So thinking very intentionally about what job you take and then when you will take the next job. And many of you will take more jobs than we ever had. So just that bit of advice about being very, very thoughtful in that regard.
So I actually think that my career path is probably the most different from the three of yours, and it wasn't at all intentional. And I've many times been so amazed when I hear people like Bob or Barbara or Jerry talk about their education and their career goals and this sort of linear path that they moved along. I'm just so amazed by that because for me, my life has just been like this, a sort of spiral. So I thought I would talk in maybe a more personal way about my path through my education and then my career as a higher ed administrator and professor. Because I think that there will probably be at least one young woman in this room that might find something in my story that will perhaps give them hope and help them imagine a different future, okay? So hopefully there will be something that is interesting to the rest of you, but, you know, I have to believe there's one person in this room that maybe will hear something in my story that will help them. So I got married really young. I was a sophomore, and I stopped out of college. I didn't drop out of college. I just stopped. And started working as a switchboard operator in this building for the university. And I had a baby. The next year I was in the hospital when I had my first anniversary in my marriage. I started back to school about 6 months later, and from that point forward, I was always a part-time student, never went full-time. I would inch towards full-time status, but it was always determined by who I could find in my family to babysit my son when I went to school. I changed from an art major to art history largely because I could read wherever I was, and I didn't feel like I had the luxury to spend the time I might have in the studio. I was, and technically this isn't absolutely true, but for 16 years, and I think, again, this is something that distinguishes me, I was a stay-at-home mom. I got my master's and my PhD during that time period, so, you know, I obviously was attending school, producing research. When I graduated, I had my first book, so it's not like I was doing all of the traditional stay-at-home mom things, but there was an extended period of time where my principal identity was being a stay-at-home mom.
And this is sort of related to something that Barb just said. The difference was that I kept moving my publishing, my involvement with professional associations ahead during that time period. So it's not like I dropped out again or stopped out, but my interest in history and my love of teaching was continuing to move forward. My first teaching job was at BYU, and I taught there for 5 years, and in my final year there, I had the opportunity to teach their American Heritage class, which is a class required of every student that comes in the door, and during one semester, I had 3,000 students, or 3% of the students at BYU. Fantastic teaching opportunity that taught me a lot about what I was really good at and what I wasn't so good at. I had 30 TAs. It was sort of like running a small business. And it was performance teaching in a way that we don't in smaller group settings. It was really important experience for me. I won a teaching award, a teaching excellence award that was actually called the Cougar Groomer Award. And I thought it was somehow related to clothes or something until I figured out that it was indeed a great honor. I came to the University of Utah in 1993, and I began teaching for the Graduate School of Architecture. And Reba Keel invited Carolyn Bliss and Jem Frost and I to join forces and develop a first-year experience program, which was called LEAP. And today, the LEAP program enrolls and supports and nurtures more than a third of our first-year students. I learned so much about being a master teacher through that experience. In 1998, I applied for the Benyon Center Service Learning Professor and got it. And it was for a project called the Gateway Service Learning Project. And back in those days, I had 300-plus students in my Introduction to Architecture class, and the idea was that I would engage every single one of them in service learning. This was very ambitious and, again, sort of like running a small business, and we did it for 3 years, and it was fantastic. It totally changed my idea about higher ed. In 2002, I was on a panel like this one with Irene Fisher. And so thinking about this experience I'd had as a young woman, my experience in service learning, the ideas I'd been developing about powerful teaching, Irene was asked the question, how can we really move the needle? How can we really change the world for women? And she said that every time an opportunity opens up, a woman has to step up and take advantage of it. And I went home and I thought about that so much. And the next morning, the ad went out for the director of the honors program. And I thought, oh my goodness, there's just this sort of amazing coincidence between the two things. And I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it and decided I would apply for it. And it was just total long shot. But I remember, and I was thinking about you, Sylvia, last night when I was thinking about what I might say today, the way you pour yourself in everything that you do. I poured my best thinking about higher ed into the cover letter for that application. And a few months later, I was awarded that amazing opportunity and had a fantastic, fantastic run in honors. The thing that I will always remember about honors was we believed that honors could be more socially responsible, and that we could use the great insights of honors students to really envision a different world and then equip them with the tools that they need to push it forward. One of the really amazing events that I experienced when I was in honors was the community leadership program. And I just have to tell you about one more woman that so strongly influenced my thinking, and it's Cece. Cece was talking about her experience in higher education. And again, in a quite personal way, she shared her journey with a group of students. The women in the room really perked up, and we were in the Board of Regents room, and she made the point of saying, I was the only woman commissioner of higher education. And, that they wanted to understand how it was possible that she landed in that role. And one of the things that she said was that when a door opens to you, you are obligated as a woman to step through it. And you, when you're there, you might look around and think, this doesn't match me. And you can step out, but you have to step through it. It's exactly what Irene was saying. You have to step up. And the next year, when John Francis told me that he was stepping down from his job, of course, Cece's words were just in my mind that I needed to dare to step through that door and look around and see if it matched me, and be willing to step forward. One of the other things that Irene said, and I'll stop, is that when we do that, when we step into the room, when we step up, we are showing all the women around us, and I feel this so strongly as a responsibility in terms of my role as a teacher and as an administrator, we're showing all the women around us that this is possible. It is possible for a woman to be in these roles. We can do it differently. We can bring our life experience. We can bring perhaps a different set of values. But we need to step through the door.
I think they've said it all, don't you? First, I want to commend you, students, for being at the best institution you could have selected. Now, I say that in a biased way, but I also say it in a knowing way, because I've been at other institutions in our country. This is where I got my PhD, and it enabled me to have a career in higher ed that I never dreamed of. Just like Jerry and Barb and Marty have said, we didn't dream we would actually do all that we've been able to do. How does it happen? Well, as has been said, you prepare yourself as best you can. If you want to be faculty or administrator in higher ed, you want that PhD. You want the top degree in your field. And you're at one of the best institutions in so many of the fields. And as you then go to your next step, I was given some really good advice by my PhD advisor. He said, go to the best Research One institution you have an opportunity to be. So I was interviewing several places, but the best one that offered me the job was the University of Minnesota at that time. You start there, you can always go around, but you start lower, it's very hard to move up. And it's because the expectations of the best institutions in this country, they want the best faculty and administrators so they can recruit the best students. So again, I want to commend you students for choosing the University of Utah. So we don't plan our careers. They sometimes happen, but some things can make them happen for all of you, all of us. Mentoring. We don't do this alone. We have really important mentors, men and women. Building networks. Building networks will help you no matter what you do in life. People say, well, what do you do now? I say, I'm a connector. What do you mean a connector? Oh, I connect people with institutions. I connect people with jobs. Whatever. If I know someone and someone is asking about, I connect people. Help with opportunities for others. Okay. So I started out as a very young PhD, 26, this institution. I had been widowed at age 24. So you say, well, wow. I was teaching English at Olympus High School when I was widowed. And I thought, if I want to live, I want to make a difference. First, after that kind of experience at that age, you don't want to live. But when you decide you want to live, you say, okay, I want to make a difference. And I had wonderful mentors, both men and women. And just like Barb and others, as an undergraduate student, I was very shy as an undergraduate student at Utah State University. But I had mentors there who helped me see through student development, student activities, leadership training, that I could do some things. So that has stayed with me. So be involved. Build those networks. Use those mentors. They want to be used. They want to assist you. That's part of their contribution of giving back to the institutions and the people that influence them. Well, I won't go into all the details about University of Minnesota and University of Iowa, but they were wonderful 15 years. Outside of the state, I thought I'd never be able to return, but one of my mentors followed me, tracked me, kept track of what I was doing. The other advice I would give you, if you want administration, also be faculty. Don't be one of them. Be one of us. Because if you are just an administrator and not also a faculty, the faculty will feel you have not walked in their shoes. So teach, do the research, do the writing, be one of them. So we're one of us. You know, it's not a we-they situation. And I found that to be true at every level of administration in my experience. Okay, so you find you're in a position that you didn't even ever dream you would be, and that's a state higher education executive officer. They're called SHEOs, and I remember when I was made, and I was 51 when I was a SHEO of the state of Utah. You say, what does that commissioner role do? Well, there is a board of regents appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and they choose a CEO. And that CEO nationally is called a state higher education executive officer. And I remember when I went to the first national meeting, there were four other women from across the country. So I flippantly said, oh, another thing is to keep your sense of humor. I flippantly said, well, why do you guys call yourselves SHEOs? You should be HEOs. You're mostly men. They laughed, but they thought, ah. A career you don't plan for, but you do walk through the door, as Marty said, because you want to explore what is on the other side and what can I contribute to what's on the other side and how can I help others, both young women and young men, how can I help others come through that door and achieve their goals and their aspirations in education. And there is nothing more gratifying than having a career in education, helping others reach their goals. And I, you know, we want some time for questions, so I don't think I'll rattle on anymore. These women said it all, really. All I did was kind of cap it a little.
Thank you, all of you. In a moment, I'd like to open up for questions, but I've got a follow-up question that is kind of basic to what we're talking about today. Each of you made decisions about continuing your educations to the doctorate level. I went online to the U.S. Department of Education yesterday and was looking at some statistics relative to the state of Utah, and I was surprised. The latest statistic, or the most recent I found relative to high school graduates for women, is that in 2003 and 2004, Utah had the highest number percentage of females graduating from high school in the United States, 88%. In a 2010-11 study, Utah was 33rd of 53 states and territories in terms of college graduation in general, men and women. And I'm not sure how that breaks down, but there is a marked decrease in continuing the process through college, through getting a university degree. I'd like you to address, if you could, the shift in emphasis. There's clearly an emphasis for high school graduation, but it seems to drop dramatically when you get to the university level, and perhaps in general talking about that and the value you see in your own careers and in your futures for having made that choice to continue. Barb, you want to go?
Well, it's true that we see disparaging statistics relative to degree completion among both men and women, but particularly among women. And some of that is cultural. Some of it is a result of where we are, and people we have the highest percentage of married students at graduation, and people drop out to begin families earlier or stop out, hopefully stop out. But we're working hard to try to look at those numbers, and all of this group are engaged actively in trying to improve those numbers for women to graduate. I've said on many occasions that Cece could actually be our poster child. Look at what her life would have been like if she had decided not to continue with her education.
I'd be teaching English still.
high school
English teacher.
Yeah. And I mean what I say, that when I teach my graduate class, I tell these students they get tired of hearing it, but really, an advanced degree is really a credential that allows you to walk through the door. And in many institutions, if you don't have that credential, you're stopped from walking through the door. And in many facets of life, if you don't have a certain set of experiences. So broadening, as Jerry mentioned, broadening what you do as an undergraduate, leadership opportunities, and taking advantage of not just academic credentials, although they're important, but every opportunity that you have to learn and grow and build a transferable skill that you can move to another area is really what's going to allow you to take that next step. And in higher education, it's very clear, but in life in general, if you don't have a baccalaureate degree, the opportunities that are going to present themselves in your lifetime are severely limited. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm so glad to have so many students here and so glad to have so many students at the university who obviously recognize that value, but we're losing far too many of them.
I like to add on to that. I'm a member of a network of professional women, and thanks to Jenna Kelson and others, we've decided for the next couple of years we're going to focus on that statistic you mentioned about women completing their degrees in Utah, because national statistics that I looked at yesterday indicate that more than half of the baccalaureate and master's degrees are earned by women, and almost half of the doctorate degrees. So Utah is behind those national averages. And in addition to the personal fulfillment that you have and the opportunities you have, the benefit to society of being able to have as wide a talent pool as possible is very clear. So that's why this group is trying to figure out ways, mentoring, networking, finding scholarship opportunities, supporting institutions that have resource centers that help them. We're trying to figure out how we can help nudge that statistic along. Maybe 30 seconds or so on my own decision. I loved school. I mean, I wasn't quite so linear. I started out as a journalist and decided I wanted to go back and be a teacher like most of the people in my family were. But I loved school, and I originally envisioned myself becoming a university professor and pursuing some research interests. As I say, I kind of fell into administration. In my case, at the University of Iowa, Cece will remember this. I joined a faculty that was very creative and tumultuous, and between the spring when they hired me and the fall when I arrived, half the faculty quit. And then the senior faculty member died of a heart attack in the middle of the year, so they looked around and they said, you're the only one left.
Well.
Who can fill in all of Mal's committee assignments. And so I did. And that's where having the background of leadership helped, because I said, oh, sure, I can do that. So I really did not intend to go into administration. It just built from there. But everyone who said, if you do aspire to a career, especially in higher education, that doctorate degree is crucial.
Here's another poster child. Mm-hmm. We're all poster children, right? But it's never too late.
Yes, exactly.
Continue your education. Things happen in your life, and you say, oh, now I have to stop out. Mm-hmm. Don't drop out. Stop out forever long you need, but continue. Come back. Finish your educational goals. Because, as it turns out, in the future, you'll have wonderful opportunities as well. I didn't mention that when I moved from Iowa back to Utah, I brought a 5-year-old little girl with me and a husband. But she loved school, too. Mm-hmm. And she had some siblings. My second husband had been married before. Some older siblings who went to the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, MIT. I mean, so she thought, well, I don't need to go to a Utah institution. And it was Lloyd Newell who told her how fine this institution is. And if she did as well as she could here, she could go anywhere for a graduate school or whatever. And it turned out to be that way. But I tell you, she married early. And I thought, why did we move back to Utah? Here's my daughter getting married early. She can't drop out of school. And, of course, she didn't. She married a spouse who was very supportive, both reaching their educational goals. So it's very important. And the mentoring that she received at this institution, there isn't a better mentor at this place than Dave Pershing. and who turned out to be a chemical engineer too? Mm-hmm. My daughter. Mm-hmm. And she got her PhD, and hope she doesn't watch this on TV. She got her PhD at the University of Texas at Austin and did some work at Rice, and she said, Mom, at those institutions, I was as competitive as the graduate students coming mm-hmm. from MIT, from Stanford, from any place across the country. So this institution will prepare you so well to build your dreams and fulfill them. And again, we just commend you for being here and realize, you see how we've done it all differently? You'll do it differently too, but you'll find your way and you'll take the advantage of the opportunities given you here, and you'll use your networks and your mentoring, and you'll have good experiences, I'm sure. And just don't worry if you have to stop for a minute, take a breath. But then, as Marty said, you walk through that door because it will open. There will always be doors opening for you, and I commend you all.
The other thing I would add to that is, you know, we talk a lot about improving our four-year graduation rates and our six-year graduation rates, and I always have in the back of my mind we ought to be celebrating those students who graduate in 8 years as well. Mm-hmm. Sure. they should receive some sort of persistence award or stick-to-itiveness or steadiness, because you know, the pace of it is going to be really different for all of us. And if you set the goal of achieving a master's degree and you start working on it, you will eventually get to the point where you're done. And if you set that goal of receiving a PhD and you do it every single semester, you never take summer off and you never take fall off, it will eventually get you to the point where you receive it. And in my experience, getting the PhD just sort of explodes the world of possibilities for you. It's just an amazing opening that it creates for you. And, you know, how deeply many of us desire to have a life of scholarship and a life of teaching and a life of involvement in the activity that is at the heart of a university, you know, that all is just thrown toward you once you get that PhD. It really is a worthy goal. If you have any interest in higher education, you just need to put that in front of you and never lose sight of that goal and steadily move towards it.
Questions? I will be passing around a mic, so before you ask your question, please state your name and major or the department you're from.
Hello, thank you. I'm Kathy Chambliss, and I am a research associate here at the Center for Public Policy Administration, and I'm also adjunct faculty. Mm-hmm. And I've had the luxury of attending a lot of the sessions this week of the Siciliano Forum talking about the future of higher ed, and so I want to connect what you've been saying today about what all the challenges we've been hearing about, starting out with the movement towards online education and people not being able to take credit without coming to campus, without feeling connected to the university community, and what does that say? How is higher ed supposed to address that? And also the cost issue. So how can you imagine that you can have the mentoring experience and the modeling experience that Jack Newell talks about, mentoring and modeling, where you have these forces that are pulling us away from a community? How can you create an honors experience or a LEAP experience for every student, not just those students who enroll in that, and in order to counterbalance what's happening? I mean, is it possible to do that? Can you envision that?
Absolutely. That's one of our number one goals of the campaign to transform the undergraduate experience, to engage every single first-year student in a cohort, in a learning community. And we're gonna get there. And those are face-to-face communities. Those aren't hybrids or online communities. Those are face-to-face communities, tend to be fewer than 30 students. But we think that's the single best way to set a student up for success. So that's our goal.
Is there a business model that will support that, given what we have now with the way we're structured?
Okay, let me
I think most universities have been dealing with the issue of online education for a portion of their student body for some time. I thought Dr. Warnock's comments were sort of deliberately provocative to get people thinking about the future, because the model he proposed of the lecturer in front of the classroom does not apply in most places at the university. There are some disciplines, there are some courses where that may be true. At Central, I can speak to that probably most recently. We had 20% of our classes taught online, in addition to the main campus, which was in Ellensburg, Washington. That was a small town. We had university centers scattered around the state, three on the west side of the Cascade Mountains, three on the east side, recognizing that, as Cece and Marty have been saying, a good portion of our student body was non-traditional. In other words, the so-called non-traditional student is becoming the traditional student, someone who stops out for a while and comes back. For them, they were highly motivated, and they identified very strongly with the campus they went to. We provided first-year experience orientation for them, but they were so motivated they were going to move ahead no matter what. Otherwise, you're doing for other students, even at a large university, what Marty's talking about, the first-year experience, making them a community when they arrive, especially on a big campus. And then they will feel tied in to knowing where the library is. They have friends and so forth. So you can do it. And you can even do it with online education, because that turns out to be a component of the education. It's not the entire education. So I don't know that I have a business model, but I can say that it certainly worked at Central, and I think most campuses are struggling with this and coming up with similar solutions. Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the most powerful retention strategies we have, so it's a priority. And it's particularly impactful on the lives of young women, more impactful than on young men.
Yep. May I also add, too, though, it turns out that there's a lot of emphasis being placed nationally on the freshman year experience, but we lose a lot of students in the sophomore year and the junior year and the senior year. So the freshman year, of course, is the most important, but we're looking carefully at what are we doing for students who decide at the end of 2 years, I'm not quite invested enough to finish, so I'm going to stop out. So what are we going to do to make sure that we make it as easy as possible and get those students connected in at every level, not just the freshman level?
So my name is Erica Martinez. I'm a sophomore here at the university, and I'm majoring in exercise science. My question is, first I'll give you some background. I know a woman, a very strong woman, and she's 40. And she dropped out of school, stopped out, the term that you guys used, because of economic circumstances. Mm-hmm. And she wants to start up again, but feels a little stuck on her position. What's some advice that you would give her?
Well, stuck on her position in terms of she doesn't have the resources to come?
So she didn't graduate, so she doesn't have her high school diploma, so her GED. And she doesn't know where to begin.
She does or does not have the GED?
She does not.
Does not. Okay.
And she wants to get the higher education. So what is some advice that you would give to her?
She could either take the GED or go to a community college where you don't have to have a GED, get her general education completed, an associate degree at a community college, then transfer to a four-year institution. So she should be encouraged. I mean, 40 is young. 40 is young.
It's younger every day.
40 is the new 30. What? So encourage her to do that. And, we have at this state, I mean, we have wonderful institutions at every level. And they have partnerships. And you can transfer from one to another. You need to do well wherever you go. But doors would be open to her. She need not have the high school diploma to go to a community college.
One of the most compelling reasons for not continuing that we heard about was financial. So that does lead me to wonder if there's a financial issue. Mm-hmm. And I would say checking with the financial aid office to see what support she might qualify for, too. I know that's important. Mm-hmm.
There's someone back there?
Yes.
There's more financial aid that goes unused than you could believe. So all organizations that deal with higher ed in any way and have financial assistance, some based on scholarship, some based on need. But, yeah, there's a lot that's unused because people just don't either know about it. But so tell her to go to some counselors and find out where those financial resources are for her.
My name is Belinda Otukolo-Saltiban, and technically Dr. Bradley is my boss here.
So, good boss.
I'm an adjunct faculty in the LEAP department, but my question is, first of all, I want to say there's no doubt that you guys are passionate, compassionate, but there's also the elephant in the room, for me at least, that there isn't a woman of color up there. And granted, our positionalities as well as our experiences are different. And I know you guys talk about opportunities exploding once you get a PhD. I have yet to see that. So my question is the lack of ethnic or racial diversity here on the panel kind of a reflection of higher ed administration at an institutional level? I know the University of Utah has its own issue with ethnic and racial diversity, but I'm just curious as to, you guys have been in different institutions. You guys are aware of, or I should say you ladies are aware of, you know.
You can call us guys.
Okay. Are aware of, you know, the ethnic makeup, and oftentimes I feel like as women of color, we're still knocking on the door and not even cracking that glass ceiling. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to hear your perspective on how that is, what your perspective is on women of color in higher ed administration.
First, look around the room and see the diversity in this room. I'm very pleased to see that. I also would like to say that for one college, and I'm sorry the former dean of education had to leave to go to a meeting, now the interim senior vice president for academic affairs. The College of Education at this institution is as diverse as I have seen any college of education any place in the country. A lot of diversity there. So kind of look around a little more. I think we need to pay more attention to diversity in leadership positions. And that's not easy to say or do, but it's possible. And I think we all need to partner in making that happen. It just doesn't happen overnight, but it's important. It's important that you serve as role models for other young professionals, other students, et cetera. It's important for the University of Utah to let the state of Utah know how the diverse populations are thriving and succeeding here. Because this is a very different state. I mean, we all have connections in other states. This is my home state. I'm very proud. I'm not embarrassed to be from Utah. But I must say that my father said when I was recruited back, and it was back to Utah State, he said, you need to take your resume and strike out everything that has to do with equal opportunity, women's rights. And I said, Dad, then I just throw away half of my resume, my CV. But there is a readiness for opportunity for people of diverse backgrounds in every way, shape, and form, but it takes all of us to work towards that to make it happen. And don't give up.
And I'd like to say, even though the results may not indicate this, I can't think of a search that we have done on this campus where we haven't made a concerted effort to include a diverse pool. It's a challenge for us to do it here, but I'm involved in many, many searches in my own division and across the university and at the cabinet level, and diversity of race, ethnicity, gender is always a part of what we're looking at. We have done a much better job of expanding our student ethnic diversity than we have our faculty and staff. Some institutions have done a better job with their faculty and staff than they have with their students. So we've got to catch up. We absolutely have to catch up. And there are concerted efforts, and there are resources being put toward doing exactly that. Our outcome has not been would not be indicative of how much effort has actually been put into it. But we're still working on it. We're not giving up.
From the standpoint of another state, I agree with what Barbara said. I'm aware of what the University of Utah has done to try to make sure the pools are as diverse as possible.
Washington had an initiative years ago that limited what you could do in the name of affirmative action. Mm-hmm. So when we try to create a diverse pool, we just broaden the pool as much as possible. Worked very hard at that, and I think what I said about women in higher ed would be the same with ethnic diversity, which you need to get more people in the pipeline, you know, with the PhDs, with the experience and the background. What we found at Central, a small school, was we worked very hard for diversity by broadening the pool, widening the pool, but they were highly recruited. The diversity mm-hmm. candidates were highly recruited and were hired elsewhere, including many of our faculty were hired elsewhere. So it's not that it isn't a goal. Mm-hmm. You need to keep the pipeline as full as possible and then realize that you may be grooming someone to move up to another great opportunity that sometimes mm-hmm. happens. But it's not for lack of commitment, either here or elsewhere.
Unfortunately, that is all of our time today. So in conclusion, I would like to thank our partner, the Honors College. I know Dean Torti is here somewhere. There she is. You've been great. We've been lucky to partner with this, the Honors College, not only for this forum today, but for the entire week's events that is the Siciliano Forum. In addition, they are celebrating their 50th anniversary on this campus, and they've been a great partner. We can thank them for the lunch in the back, which was wonderful. Thank you for providing that. And finally, I'm inspired. So thank you. Please join me in thanking our wonderful panelists for this great forum.